I don't think it's about these tech giants being unsophisticated as readers. I don't see their non-engagement with social commentary in the works that you've referred to as missing something, but rather as actively ignoring, erasing, eliding, occluding, obscuring, etc. Insofar as it's inconsistent with their social, political, economic, cultural, and other commitments, right? And there's a whole body of philosophical and sociological literature exploring this phenomenon of active ignoring, which is referred to as agnotology, the making and unmaking of ignorance. It's, if you like, it's the complement to epistemology, how we construct knowledge or come to know things, right? This is agnotology. This is how we come or how they come to actively ignore X, Y, and Z.
Welcome to Politics, a show where two software developers break the fourth wall and talk about the interlacing of technology and politics. I'm Josh.
And I'm Ray. We see technologies like crypto, AI, and surveillance infecting our politics. Meanwhile, governments and the media are making out that all this is inevitable. We can't leave the future in the hands of scheming technology leaders and their pet politicians.
We're here to raise our voice and open up the space for honest, good faith discussions. To help us organize and sharpen our ideas, we've invited some interesting and highly respected thinkers to share their understanding and their research with us and, of course, with you.
Politics is where we smash the myths and get to the truth.
Ray, we need to talk about science fiction.
I don't know anything about science fiction. Well, I know a little bit. You know, I've seen Aliens and I've seen Terminator. We need to get someone on that knows more about science fiction than I do. Let's make that happen, Josh.
I think that's a great idea, Ray. I have a perfect guest in mind and I've reached out and invited him on, and he has graced us with his presence tonight. So I'm happy to introduce to everyone Dr. Syed Mustafa Ali. Dr. Ali, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Well, thank you for the invitation. Honored and humbled.
So before we jump into the meat of things, I wondered if you wanted to just introduce yourself to the audience and give them a little background on yourself.
Okay, sure. I'm a lecturer at the Open University in the UK in the School of Computing and Communications. And in that school, I convene a research group called Critical Information Studies. And as part of my research within that group, I approach computing, ICT, IT, and related phenomena primarily through the lens of critical race theory and decolonial thought, but increasingly, more recently, through the lenses of political economy, political ecology, and political theology.
Right. Oh, who knew that politics and technology were intersecting?
Yeah, exactly right. So that's really interesting. Yeah, political economy, political ecology, and political theology, you said. I think it's very apropos that we're going to talk about Dune, speaking of political ecology, because I know that there's a heavy vein of ecology running through that. And Frank Herbert at least wrote about ecology, I know. So looking forward to hear your thoughts on that. But first, I wanted to maybe just back up and ask you, you know, what is the deal with science fiction? So we have noted before on this show that there are fantastical science fiction narratives that are being used, you know, narratives about Skynet and existential threats to kind of cover up what's really happening here. Don't pay attention to the real existing harms of AI, but instead worry about killer robots or whatever. So given this, why do you think it's important to engage with the narratives behind sci-fi?
Okay, let me try to offer a few reasons. So firstly, I think it's important to appreciate that sci-fi narratives are only contingently, that is, not necessarily or inherently, occlusive or obfuscatory of the real and the present, right? The contemporary moment, if you like. In fact, as various scholars in science fiction studies have argued, and quite convincingly in my view, science fiction as a historically situated phenomenon is essentially an often veiled commentary on the real and the present.
Yeah.
And I think this applies to AI, however we might unpack that rather nebulous, if not amorphous term. Now, secondly, I need to draw attention to the role of science fiction in the formation of what is referred to as socio-technical imaginary or imaginaries. That is, perceptions, discourses, narratives, imaginings, and future visions in the negotiated interactions associated with technological development in the real and the present. In short, this is not just about speculative futures distracting from real and present concerns, although I don't dispute that's happening, but also about how futures shape the understanding and the developmental trajectory of the present. Furthermore, the roles played by various actors, both dominant and, if you like, resistant in such understanding and social shaping, including of technology. Now, thirdly, I want to suggest that the idea of existential threat can be understood in at least two ways, one which we might regard as absolute and the other as relative. In my earlier work exploring transhumanism and cognate phenomena such as AI, I argue for the value of adopting a more relational reading of existential threat, more specifically, one that invites us to think about these phenomena in world systems terms. So that's the relation, if you like, between the core or the center and the periphery, the margins, etc. On this basis, and adopting a race-critical and a decolonial perspective, I maintain that one can usefully think about these phenomena. That's phenomena such as existential risk, existential threat, those kind of discourses, as a technocentric response by whiteness, by which I mean essentially white supremacy, to mounting non-white contestation of the former with the aim of maintaining white hegemony. Right? So this is a relational understanding of the idea of existential threat and existential risk. And maybe finally, I should like to draw attention to an important statement made by Marxist sociologist of technology Richard Barbrook in his 2007 work entitled Imaginary Futures from Thinking Machines to the Global Village. And the statement is as follows. Those who forget the future are condemned to repeat it. Now, I think this statement, which is essentially a riff on or a riff off of the philosopher George Santayana's insistence that those who forget history are condemned to repeat it, points to the importance of producing critical histories of the future or futures with a view to disrupting the socio-technical imaginaries of dominant actors. And in addition, and perhaps a little obviously, there's also the quip from George Orwell, his ominous assertion in 1984, that those who control the past control the future, and those that control the present control the past.
Well summed up there. One of the things we've talked about before on this show is that the role that technology has played has, you know, become more political over time. I think it's been political for a long time, but it's more evidently political today in the Trump inauguration, for example, with the tech oligarch sitting behind him. Now, I know that in the Luddite times, you know, we can always look back and say, well, technology has always been linked to politics, and we can definitely go there a bit later. But the specific technology of the internet, the dominant technology of today, is explicitly linked to the hegemony, to the American core, the empiric core of the United States. And one of the things that we know in the narrative is that the concept of America controlling and owning and dominating the technological sphere is really part of this project. And they're using like the Red Scare, the scare about China, as part of that means of funding it, of maintaining it, of propagating it. Is that the kind of thing that resonates with your perspective there?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I wouldn't want to push back against that in the sense of discounting it or suggesting that that reading is incorrect. And I think you kind of already gestured in this direction by, you know, situating contemporary developments within big tech, if you like, in relation to shifts within hegemony or contestations of hegemony, US empire, it morphing into something else, perhaps. And I think that was usefully situated against the backdrop of a slightly longer durée historical phenomenon, which is Luddism, right? So in 19th century. But I mean, I take the view, and this is my, if you like, I guess you can say my philosophical, political, and other position on this, is that technologies are always already political, social, cultural, economic, etc., right? So the technical for me is always an abstraction from the socio-technical, right? Now, many of my, for example, colleagues in my school would contest that view, right? Their orientation would be, well, no, this is purely technical. It's applied science, which is a really naive position anyway.
Yeah.
But it's purely technical, and it is only subsequently socio-technical through usage.
I don't buy that.
And I want to push back against that.
Yeah,
I want to push back against that, right? Because I'm suggesting that makes the presumption that the socio-technical essentially wedded exclusively to use, to utility.
Right.
So it's a very instrumentalist reading, right?
Yeah.
And where does that leave creation, bringing into being, the embedding of values, of dispositions, orientations, not to mention entanglements with funding agencies.
Absolutely.
The broader socio-political, economic, and other context and backdrop against which these developments emerged, if you like, the material conditions, right, for the emergence of these phenomena. So I just don't buy that at all. For me, we start with the socio-technical. We can abstract away from that to the purely technical. But I would suggest there's a certain violence at work in that abstraction. And that is that it obscures, erases, brackets out the embedding fabric, which is, I would suggest, a necessary condition, not the only condition, but a necessary condition for the emergence of these technologies.
Yeah.
I guess where I'm going maybe slightly differently to you in your reading is, I mean, I take empire, and I'm not suggesting maybe that you don't agree with this, perhaps, but I'm suggesting that empire, at least in its, since the onset of European colonialism, empire has been entangled with racialization, and it continues to be so, even in the so-called post-racial moment, which itself
what
is
that mean?
Well, I mean, yeah, apart from it being a kind of bullshit distractor, right? I mean, a functioning mask, right? I think with the emergence of kind of like a more overt, crude form of white supremacy that we're seeing in, if you want to think about it in left-right terms, as a kind of right, if not far-right shift under, you know, figures like Trump, but we're seeing the same thing in the UK, across Europe more broadly, and elsewhere, right?
Yeah.
So I would entangle with that the rise of an extreme right form of kind of nativist Hinduism in the Hindutva movement in India, right?
Sure.
And developments that are kind of cognate to that in South America, right? So there's a global circulating logic which is classed, is gendered, but I would absolutely insist that it continues to be racialized and colonial in some sense, right? Because for me, the racial and the colonial are always entangled.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that pushes back against you, Ray, or more it just complements what you're saying.
Well, I don't feel pushed back against. I mean,
I'll try harder next time.
You'll definitely get me next time. Yeah, I think one of the things I want to pick up on slightly is that in terms of like the reason why I think, because we had this discussion before as well, myself and Josh in earlier episodes, is about this concept of people derive technology from apparently purely Platonic thought. You know, people like, oh, we do algebra in our head, we play a computer, and therefore, you know, if all I do is create a function or I put some numbers in, I get some numbers out, and therefore it's a purely abstract thing that I'm doing. And yet we all work, well, no, maybe it's not we all, but most of us work for large corporations that are doing something effectful in the world.
Right.
So this concept that we can separate out the technology from its application just seems completely ludicrous to me. So I definitely don't feel pushed back against that. You know, I feel like we have to attack and dismantle that way of thinking about technology, in fact.
Absolutely.
Because it's, you know, it's both naive and dangerous, you know, because it presupposes that one can create new things that are completely devoid of any meaning or any application or any implication.
Yeah. I mean, and even if it were true that technology is just applied science, I mean, as if science itself is not political, you know, that's ludicrous. Because as you said, just doing a materialist analysis, science is funded, right? Science comes from people. People have political views. People are involved in political projects. So, I mean, I think you can see it extremely clearly with large language models, right? That's coming out of a certain political milieu, if you will. You know, Karen Howe makes that point in her great book, Empire of AI. She's saying, look, it didn't have to be this way. It could have been elsewise. However, it came out of a specific place, you know? And I think that really kind of goes to what you're saying about there is no kind of pure technology, and it's only the application of the technology that makes it political. That just seems absurd to look at it that way.
But I think sometimes this is what goes through people's heads in this concept that science is not political, and we're just telling the truth. We're just telling it as we see it. It's just pure. All we're doing is explaining how the world works in scientific terms. It's a pure site of knowledge rather than the site of contestation. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, I like Josh's point as well about, well, I think maybe you made this as well, Ray, you know, the idea of mathematics as somehow platonic, you know, existing in some maybe ethereal, immaterial realm.
Yeah, yeah.
And that might be true, right? That might be true. Mathematics might exist in such a realm, right?
For some of it, yeah.
But that doesn't change the fact that mathematicians are embodied beings situated in the world, right? I mean, very few mathematicians live as hermits outside of polities. Right? Mm. I mean, I don't know if there are any that are like that, because quite frankly, if there were, how would we know about them, right? They would have to interact yeah. somehow with the polity for us to know that, oh, there's a guy, a hermit in a cave somewhere, having these deep insights into, I don't know, Cantorian set theory or something like that. Right?
Yeah.
The calculus, whatever, right? So that kind of gives the, you know, it kind of makes a mockery of this whole idea that even if we accept that a metaphysical view that mathematics is in some sense platonic, right? Mathematicians are not.
Right. Exactly.
Right? I mean, there may be a very complex bridge between the material and the platonic if you want to explore that kind of metaphysics. I'm not suggesting we do so. But, you know, it's a candidate, at least, right, for argumentation and exploration and contestation. But just to kind of ground this maybe a bit more in relation to computing, per se, right, this is why I don't claim to be a computer scientist. I've never claimed to be a computer scientist. I'm not a computer scientist. I'm not a practitioner. But I would say that I engage with computing, right?
Yeah.
And computing for me is a socio-technical phenomenon.
Yep.
Right? So I absolutely do computing, right? But I think those who are doing computer science, and this isn't to mock, ridicule, attack, or anything then, right? Is to simply open the space up to say, well, what does it mean to do science in the way that you were suggesting, Josh, right? You know, and you know, science and technology studies scholars and social construction of technology scholars and philosophers of science and sociologists of science, they've all explored this, right? That, you know, you're talking about an embodied, embedded, situated, historical phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't sit well with those who are trying to push a kind of more technologically determinist narrative, saying, well, this is just the unfolding of something that was inherent with the Big Bang or the quantum fluctuation or whatever is the onset of the cosmos, right?
Yeah, some teleological perspective around how the future must evolve.
Yeah, right. And but one thing I just want to smuggle in here, because you made reference to maybe Karen Howe, you know, saying the future didn't have to be like this, or the present didn't have to be like this, et cetera, right? Which is pointing to contingency. And I did mention contingency in my answer to your, or my attempted answer to your first question.
You did indeed.
But sometimes there is this is just my opinion now, there's a certain smugness associated with the appeal to contingency. Right, it's almost like a kind of gotcha moment, right? This is contingent. It didn't have to be like this. Decisions were made by differentially positioned stakeholders and actors and players and the rest of it, right? So on the one hand, you've got the, you know, let's call them the tech bros as the inheritors of this kind of progress narrative that says, you know, there's a kind of linear arc and it's ascending. Essentially, this is driven by technology, a form of technological determinism.
Yes. Right?
So that's one camp. The other extreme camp, I would suggest, are there other smug critics of this view saying, well, no, that's not right. Because if you actually do a materialist analysis, you'll see that there are various contingencies and it didn't have to be like this. Now, I want to position myself, if this makes any sense, between the two camps.
Sure.
By which I say, and want to suggest, contingency, yes, but let's take stock of probability. Mm-hmm. In other words, where is this thing headed? All things being equal, right? So I'm suggesting that there is a tendency, an affordance, a disposition, what some scholars like Thomas Hughes refer to as a technological momentum, if not acceleration, associated with ongoing developments, right? So I'm not suggesting contingency should be discarded, and I certainly am not embracing necessity, but I'm suggesting that in between this lies probability. Mm-hmm. And that's where I suggest the struggle needs to be taken.
So like Paul Atreides, we must gaze into all of the possible futures. Speaking as we were of the broligarchy, which always amuses me to say, so I'll say it again, the broligarchy, who were, as Ray mentioned, lurking behind Trump at the inauguration. There we go. So, you know, some of those very people are reportedly big science fiction fans. You know, they've talked about being inspired. I know Elon Musk, for example, talks a lot about the Foundation series. Bezos apparently loved The Expanse so much that he bought the rights once the show was canceled and resurrected it on Amazon Prime. And Mark Zuckerberg is obviously so taken with Snow Crash that he thinks the metaverse is, like you said, not a kind of critical commentary coming from a specific point in time, but the metaverse is this great thing that he should build and we should all be in. So I'm kind of wondering here, you know, because The Expanse also, I think, is a very critical look at the dynamics between, you know, the core and the periphery, as you were saying before. But for Bezos, apparently, it's just space opera. You know, for Zuck, Snow Crash is this amazing, like, oh, the metaverse, we definitely need that. Everybody loves it. So what's going on with these guys? Like, are they really such unsophisticated readers of science fiction? Or is there something else happening?
Okay, well, I mean, maybe just to comment briefly on The Expanse and Jeff Bezos resurrecting the series or continuing the series on Prime. I mean, maybe that's why the last seasons were so bad, right? I'm not a fan of the first season, but I really liked, I think, 2, 3, and 4, where it got deeply political.
Yeah.
And then I think it just fell off a cliff, or at least it did for me. And eventually I was just like, I'm done with that, right? Move on to something else. Yeah, I mean, this is a really good question. I mean, when we're talking about, you know, as you say, texts like Asimov's Foundation series, which Elon Musk is a fan of, Zuckerberg's infatuation with Snow Crash in relation to the metaverse, and Jeff Bezos and The Expanse that you just mentioned, right? And, you know, you can say that, you know, they're reading this science fiction production very literally, and kind of missing the social commentary in these works. And I think as the question you're asking is, you know, is this about unsophisticated reading, or is there something else going on? So for my part, I think this has to do with how one reads texts and to what end or ends. Right? Mm-hmm. So I don't see their non-engagement with social commentary in the works that you've referred to as missing something, but rather as actively ignoring or bracketing, by which I mean erasing, eliding, occluding, obscuring, etc., such commentary, insofar as it's inconsistent with their social, political, economic, cultural, and other commitments. Right? And there's a whole body of philosophical and sociological literature exploring this phenomenon of active ignoring, which is referred to as, and here it comes, agnotology. That is, the making and unmaking of ignorance. It's the, if you like, it's the complement to epistemology, right? The study of how we know, how we construct knowledge or come to know things, right? This is agnotology. This is how we come, or how they come, to actively ignore X, Y, and Z. So in short, I don't think it's about these tech giants being unsophisticated as readers, which I think presumes that there is a sophisticated and right way to read such texts, and that these people are somehow deficient in their ability to do so. I think that way of thinking turns about a rather objectivist and rationalist conceit that suggests that if only they were sufficiently rational and well-informed, the tech giants would embrace such social commentary.
Right.
Now, that view does next to nothing for me, since I think it tends to ignore the possibility that there are these other currents, social, political, economic, cultural, but also affective or emotional, and civilizational or racial, at work alongside and perhaps also shaping what is considered rational. So that's the way I would kind of like come at the answer to your question.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I love that, you know, kind of pushing back against the idea of a right reading of a text or a sophisticated reading of a text. And you know, I can't help but be reminded a little bit of the, you know, the very idea of having a conversation with a large language model is absurd because, you know, the meaning is kind of being built up in our head as we talk to each other, right? I'm constructing a mental model of what's going on in your head inside my head, and Ray's doing the same, and this is conversation. And I think to some extent, we also do that when reading, right? We are constructing a model not only of the world that's being described, but also of, you know, what is the author doing? Sometimes I find myself when reading kind of, and reading fiction, for example, I'm kind of blasted out of the story for just a minute. Like, what in the hell are they getting? You know, why would they write that like that? But anyway, sorry, I'm gushing a little bit. I think, Ray, you looked like you had something more insightful to say.
Well, again, you're projecting quite a lot there, I think. What you were saying earlier on about the concept of sci-fi literacy is important for the current situation. Where do we see, maybe this is a tricky question, but where do we see racism in sci-fi?
Ooh. We're about to talk about Dune, aren't we? There's a little racism happening there, I think.
I don't know if it's a universal theme of sci-fi. So it's kind of like, you know, you can pick out individual things, but it is this sort of concept of, the concept of empire is very, very clear. The concept of colonialism is very clear. But the concept of, and maybe it's like you say, colonialism and racism are kind of like so intermeshed that it's like just almost a single thing. But maybe you'd like to elaborate on that a little bit.
Okay, so I don't want to be understood as essentialist about this, right? So I'm not that science fiction necessarily is racist. What I'm suggesting is that science fiction, as it emerged as a distinct genre of literature oriented largely towards the future, imaginary worlds, etc., emerges against the backdrop of a world system which is inflected by colonialism and its legacy, racialization practices, class differentials, gender oppression, etc., right? So that there are various currents that make up the backdrop against which science fiction emerges as a genre, right?
Right.
Now, again, in the same way that I was arguing for the two kind of wings, if you like, of necessity and contingency in relation to the unfolding of the socio-technical or technology, if you like, right?
Mm.
But also setting out my own stall as committed to a more probabilistic-based reading. In other words, what is the dominant trend which, if not interfered with, upset, disrupted, abolished, is going to continue, possibly gain speed? In other words, a kind of accelerationist reading of this. In the same way, I would suggest that science fiction is just like that, because it's part of a wider socio-technical imaginary, right? And so on the one hand, we could say there might be those who say, well, science fiction in and of itself is racist and all these other forms of oppression, versus no, it's completely contingent and it can be not otherwise. Again, I'd like to situate myself in true Goldilocks fashion, right in the middle, right? Playing the role of saying, well, what is the dominant trend of this discourse?
Right.
Because
right.
this discourse is as socially embedded as maybe the technology that it's talking about. Because as I mentioned earlier, I think one very useful way, and it's kind of maybe a standard read from science fiction scholars, is that science fiction is effectively a commentary on the present.
Mm-hmm.
And possibly also the geographical present, right? So history and geography always being entangled, space and time always being entangled. So that's how I would approach this. I think it's possible to do science fiction in other than, you know, sexist, classed, and racialized ways. Is that the dominant way that it's being done? I've not read enough contemporary science fiction or watched. I mean, I watch too much science fiction, right? But I've not seen enough to see anything that's doing what I would consider to be highly disruptive work, right? And you get what in the UK is referred to as EDI type science fiction. So that's a equity, diversity, and inclusion. So, you know, Doctor Who is now black, played by a gay male. I mean, the latest one I saw, which I actually consider a travesty, is that the character of Ripley from Alien is potentially to be played by a black actress, right? Huh. Now, some might champion this as a victory for EDI, right? Or DEI in the States, I think it's called. But, you know, what does that actually really do, right? I mean, sure, have a black female in some kind of successor role engaging with the xenomorph and the rest of it, right? Mm-hmm. But why does that have to be Ripley reimagined?
Yeah.
Interesting. For sure.
Yeah. Yeah, I see this as part of this horrendous kind of corporatization and a form of racialized liberal kind of policy that does distract a work, right? Because everyone's like, well, I mean, it's like the Obama moment, right? We have a black president. We now have inhabited the post-racial moment.
Right.
Really? Well, critical black scholars didn't believe that, and they turn out to be correct. In fact, he got the Nobel Peace Prize for being what? A drone president.
Yeah, unbelievable. Now, don't push that button. You're gonna make me very angry here.
Don't push you because you're close to the edge, right?
Exactly. Yeah, and I'm about to lose my head. So something you said there, I have a good friend, a childhood friend, and we kind of lost touch for a little while, but it turned out that they're a huge science fiction fan, and they were reviewing science fiction on their blog. And, you know, sci-fi publishers started just sending them books, you know, hey, please read this, whatever. And so when we got back in touch, you know, I confessed, hey, I haven't read a lot of the classics of sci-fi. You know, I've read a lot of William Gibson, Neal Stephenson, guys like that, Dune. I have read many, many times. But so I asked them, like, hey, can you help me become more widely read in science fiction? So I learned a few interesting things. So I had no idea there was kind of right-wing and left-wing sci-fi. And it's so obvious, right? Like, when I say it out loud, it's like, well, of course there is, because they're right-wing and left-wing writers, you know. But I thought that was quite interesting. And you know, in terms of your comment that I think there is science fiction being written today that is doing that disruptive work. At least I've read some queer science fiction, which is doing some really really good work, I would say, pushing back against the kind of cishet hegemony. But also, I mean, just to name check somebody, Octavia Butler, I mean, her stuff is brilliant. And it was really attacking kind of whiteness head on. And I guess she was writing in what, the 70s and 80s, maybe?
Well, maybe one thing to add to this, or to maybe bring it back onto the sort of the some of the concepts, is something that you mentioned in your Butlerian Jihad piece, Mustafa, is the otherness. And this is definitely something which we see in science fiction. You know, it's a concept of the other. You know, and that, at the end, that the fundamentals of that is a racist kind of construction. You know, it's always like that. I mean, you know, because whiteness is a construct as well.
Yeah. There's a book. I think the title of the book is Aliens Are Us. written by, I think it's Sean Cubitt and Ziauddin Sardar, who's written a number of books, the latter at least. And, you know, they explore various kind of figures in that, including, I think, the Xenomorph in the Alien franchise, mm-hmm. and possibly also the Terminator, which kind of resonates somewhat with, I guess, one of the themes I'm exploring in that particular essay, which is, you know, how the machine can be cast as other.
Mm-hmm.
Although I want to push back against that because, to my mind, you know, I mean, there's a whole body of thought called critical posthumanism. So this isn't posthumanism of the kind of Ray Kurzweil singularity,
mm-hmm.
perfume that spreads out into the universe, colonizing everything so that we become some deity or whatever, right? But this is more from the perspective of a critique of the slippage between the category of the human and white, right? So it's a contestation of that, which I think is very welcome from post-colonial and decolonial and critical race perspectives. But it also has another component, which is a critique of anthropocentrism.
Right.
Which I have some sympathy for, right? Certainly in relation to the treatment of animals and other kind of biotic entities. But there's a certain slippage in the discourse, right, which builds on the work of Donna Haraway from, I guess, the mid-80s, the Cyborg Manifesto being, I guess, the seminal essay, which is a slippage from the human through the animal through the machine. Cyborg being a kind of transhuman mediator to the machinic as some kind of autonomous entity. But in my work, I'm wanting to unpack those slippages and subject them to critique, right? Because the idea that the human, the animal, and the machine, they can all be lumped together, to me is an ontological flattening, right? They're essentially saying we're all the same. So, well, then, okay, does that mean we afford machines rights? And you can understand the train of thought, because everything you guys have been exploring on your podcast, right, in relation to large language models and, you know, the attention mechanism in that architecture. I mean, the fact that it's called the attention mechanism, my God.
Yeah.
You know, this is just kind of like more veiled anthropomorphism. Let's smuggle in more and more and more. You know, and you know, I think it was the 70s or 80s, there was this really excellent essay by, I think it was a philosopher called, maybe philosopher or computer scientist called Drew McDermott. And it was called Wishful Mnemonics. So you guys as practitioners, I mean, the idea of a mnemonic is clear to you, right?
Sure.
And, you know, he was making the argument that, you know, by referring to, I don't know, it could be a Lisp, a Lisp function or something, and giving it mnemonic mate or think or something like that, that doesn't engender thought.
Right.
Right.
No.
And the best example I have was kind of building on that was an anthropologist called Stefan Helmreich, who wrote a book called Silicon Second Life. I think that's what it's called anyway. And what he did was he would parachute into spaces like the Los Alamos National Laboratory, the Santa Fe Institute, where they were doing research in the mid-90s on artificial life, right, which is a cognate discipline to AI.
Yep.
And he was speaking to the practitioners and the modelers and the developers of these technologies. And, you know, they were saying, look, you know, life here, et cetera, et cetera. And then he was examining the code. And they would have things like operators such as mate or reproduce, right? And then you have the open bracket and you have X, Y, and blah, blah, blah. And then he was saying, well, okay, what if I was to replace mate or reproduce with kiss?
Uh-huh.
So are these two variables that get instantiated, are they now kissing? And it immediately becomes laughable.
Right.
I mean, you're laughing now.
I am, yeah.
And this is the point about wishful mnemonics and smuggling in these kind of anthropomorphisms that I suggest need to be unpacked critically in calls to, say, human, animal, machine, right? I've just set out my stall, my second stall, if you like, which is I don't embrace that view. For me, the machinic is not the same as the biological and or the human.
Yeah. I mean, I think the thing that most perplexes me about the modern kind of instantiation of this model is that there's this idea, and to your point, actually, Mustafa, is that some of these people believe that everything is computable.
Yeah.
And because they believe everything is computable, that flattens everything. That's the ultimate flattening. And I reject that completely. So that's where I'm coming from in terms of like our understanding of what it means to be computable. Now, I deny my computability.
I mean, ironically, even people like Alan Turing would deny this idea of universal computation or the idea that everything is ultimately computable, right? Because there have been theses based on Turing machines and lambda calculi and other essentially functionally or mathematically equivalent formalisms demonstrating rigorously that that is not the case.
Right? Yeah.
I mean, it's all building on Gödel's incompleteness theorem.
Exactly, yeah. Right?
So this is a case of extreme bullshit in operation. Because, forget about me talking about computing as socio-technical. Let's just enter into the more restricted, somewhat pure, in quotes, pure domain of computer science. Well, computer scientists don't believe that either.
No.
And they have the proof that that is the case.
The halting problem.
So what is actually going on, right? What is actually going on, I would suggest, is almost a step back from that. And then a really sloppy but rhetorically important invocation of computation as a universal.
Yes.
That everything is computable, right? So it's almost like, who cares what Alan Turing, Kurt Gödel, and others have, the Church Turing thesis, who gives a damn what they have demonstrated? Because actually, we will show that that is not the case, materially, empirically, etc. It's all rhetorical work, and I wouldn't mind so much if it was rhetorical work grounded in decent mathematics, right? But it's grounded in no mathematics.
Yeah, and yet these people are leading the industry and they're leading voices in this industry. No, I think it's Dennis Harabis at DeepMind that says it. I mean, I'm not saying he's the only one that says it, but he's the one that I most recently heard saying it in his sort of like roundup of AI in 2025. I tortured myself by watching this thing.
You took a hit for the team, Ray.
Yeah, I took one for the team. I mean, sometimes you got to put your face in the fire, you know, and you've just got to enter the Chernobyl building of this like AI fantasy. Yeah, so anyway, there was a small aside there, but to basically support your point, which is that, is this flattening and this concept that we, through AI, through the modern incantation of AI, we can reach the computability of everything. That in itself, to me, is complete science fiction and a complete science fantasy, actually.
But not in a good way.
But not in a good way. But it's in a way that essentially, to your point again, Mustafa, it sort of, it drives this notion that everything will be subsumed by this technology.
Yeah, I mean, it's what I opened my response to Josh's first question with, whether, I think that this is a socio-technical imaginary, right? So it's a vision, and it's not just this, but it's a vision of the future, and or futures in a very restricted frame.
Yeah.
And it's the mobilization of important institutions, policymakers, stakeholders, funders, etc., to bring about that vision, to make it happen, right? So, I mean, one example I was thinking of, I received your invitation to take part in this podcast is Star Trek, the original series, right? Mm-hmm. So the handheld communicator that flips open, right? And yeah, and then we got the, what is it, the Nokia phone?
Yeah, the flip phone, yeah.
Some decades later, right? Mirroring that. So, I mean, that's just one very kind of maybe obvious example of how, in a sense, a projected future becomes a lure into that future. And that's why these socio-technical imaginaries are really important, I would suggest, to understand and to confront.
Yeah. So speaking of which, let's understand and confront one such imaginary. So as I alluded to in the first question there, you kind of pushed back a little bit against a nice line that Dan McQuillan had in the opening of his Resisting AI, An Anti-Fascist Approach to Artificial Intelligence, which, amazing book, everybody should read it. So Dan, what he's doing in that book, he says that he is focusing on actual AI as it operates in the world and not the grandiose rhetoric or sci-fi storylines that obscure it. And you kind of quote that line in the beginning of your paper, A Butlerian Hauntology, which we're now going to proceed to talk about. And I'm just going to read this one line that you wrote because it's so good. It hits a bunch of stuff that I love here. So you say that engaging with some science fiction is warranted. A fortiori, that which appears entangled with actual and projected necropolitical violence against the wretched of the earth and rhetorical calls for countering such violence. So, I mean, what an amazing, you're invoking Fanon there, you know, friend of the show, Franz Fanon. But, you know, Dune is this big, complicated work by a deeply complicated guy, Frank Herbert, not on our side, I think we can safely say, but there's some fascinating stuff going on in the Dune universe that he's built. And, you know, so you are tackling Dune head on, and you're focusing even more specifically on kind of a backstory, which is not really more than referred to, I believe, in the original Dune novel, but this idea of the Butlerian Jihad, which was basically thinking machines had been wielded by men to oppress other men. And then there was a kind of rejection of thinking machines, as they called them. Humanity rebels and destroys them. And that's why in Dune, we have no mechanical computers. We have only the biological computers that are Mentats. So that is a long run up to the question, what is so special about this idea of a Butlerian Jihad that led you to engage with it? And, you know, the point you make in the paper is that, hey, maybe this is a thing that we should have in real life. So I'll just leave you with that.
I'd suggest that at least one reason for engaging with the Butlerian Jihad backstory to Dune is that calls for mounting a Butlerian Jihad, in quotes, if you like, against AI have already been and are continuing to be made by some tech critics. I think including the show hosts of, is it This Machine Kills?
Yeah, Jathan, right? And Ed.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, essentially those who style themselves as Luddites of some form, right? And I see this as contributing to the formation of a resistant socio-technical imaginary. So picking up on my answer to your first question on the importance of socio-technical imaginaries in relation to visions of the future, their entanglement with various diffuse actors, institutions, policies, etc., as part of the broader social, cultural, political, economic, civilizational, if you like, fabric, but doing it from a resistant position, right? Rather than a kind of mainstream dominant position. I see engaging with this backstory, the Butlerian Jihad, as contributing to the formation of a resistant socio-technical imaginary. So that would be to complement the work that's being done by colleagues like Dan McQuillan and others who are taking what they perceive as a slightly more materialist engagement with the now. I'm suggesting that the now is always entangled with the future or futures as these socio-technical imaginaries, right? And so that you can't, you can slice them away, but I'm suggesting you lose something in the process of trimming the fat. Mm-hmm. And fat's good for the body. At least some fats are good. So let's run with that. So yeah, so I mean, you've already mentioned, you know, how I'm thinking about that in terms of a kind of like response to Dan. And I've collaborated with him on a number of occasions. Sometimes we tag team, right? I think on at least one podcast, I think it's called the Exalt podcast or something. We tag teamed in that connection. And he lives locally and we meet when we can. And we're good friends and fellow Luddites, anarchists, and then some. But anyway, regarding the Dune saga, right, I think it will be fair to say that we can agree it's an epic work of world building. It's imagined by an author with problematic leanings, including those of an Orientalist nature, right? I mean, yeah. I think scholarship demonstrates this.
Yeah.
In this connection, I should like to point to the work of post-colonial science scholar Haris Durrani, who's done some really important work drawing out the various strands of thinking which inform Frank Herbert's Dune novels, including his views on ecology, which I think you mentioned earlier, but also messianism, and even his republican orientation, right? So his kind of politics in the background. So, you know, I just want to plug Horace's work, because although I differ from his reading in certain regards, I think it's really important scholarship that's been done, and he deserves recognition for that, right? However, as to my motivations for writing the aforementioned essay, A Butlerian Hauntology, I was somewhat less interested in Dune as such, and far more interested in the backstory, and for essentially two reasons. So that's in addition to the fact that there are calls for a Butlerian jihad being made by some tech critics today, right? So the first reason is the invocation of jihad, a term that has arguably somewhat different resonance today in our post-9/11 war on terror world, including a world, you know, in which Islamophobia is rampant, right? And I'm a Muslim, right? So that's quite personal to me as well. But even if I wasn't, it's part of the fabric of racialization going on in the world in relation to, for example, anti-black racism, etc. So that's the first kind of motivation, is the invocation of jihad. And then the second one is the reference to Butler. Who's this Butler, right?
Yeah, who indeed?
You know, when I started to dig into the Encyclopedia of Dune and other things, you know, finding out a little bit about the backstory, apparently it's the figure Serena Butler, who is this kind of figure who is the kind of driving force, mobilizing people in the war against the thinking machines and cognitive technologies, robots, etc., etc., right? But that wasn't what resonated in my head. And the reason being is I had read a book by George Dyson. I think it's called Darwin Among the Machines.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? I'd only read the first chapter at the time. And he was making reference to a very interesting figure that I want to talk about now. So, yeah, I thought, let's try to dig into who this Butler might be. I mean, it might be Serena Butler, but Serena Butler might actually be a kind of figure that's a placeholder for some other Butler. So who's this other Butler? And the funny thing is, when I wrote the essay, people thought I was talking about Judith Butler.
No.
So this isn't a Judith Butlerian hauntology we're talking about, right? There are other Butlers in the universe, including in the Duneverse, right? So, okay. I mean, in the essay, what I try to do is construct what I see as a plausible genealogy for Herbert's Butlerian jihad, right? Tracing it to some newspaper articles written by, and here it comes, another Butler with the same initials, S. Butler. This is Samuel Butler, an author, a sheep farmer, and a commentator on Darwinism living in New Zealand in the 1860s, right? So in the 19th century. Now, these articles, the first of which was entitled Darwin Among the Machines, and as I said, that's the title of the book by George Dyson. And this essay, this first newspaper article, was published in 1863. Well, these articles are fascinating, right? There are three of them. Insofar as they set out in somewhat kind of classic dialectical fashion, so that's, if you like, thesis, antithesis, and synthesis, three positions on what the political theorists of technology Langdon Winner refers to as autonomous technology, which today I suggest we most readily associate with AI, cognate phenomena such as artificial life, robots, etc. So these are the three positions. And I'll just summarize them because I mean, anyone who's interested, they can download the article. It's open access, free, etc. And they can see a more expanded kind of presentation of these three positions. But the first one is war against the machines. The second position is augmentation of the human via machines. I guess today that would resonate with transhumanism, at least on some readings, right? And third, domination by the machines, which is the standard existential threat of paperclips and blah, 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 all of this stuff. Right? kind of posthumism, right? On steroids.
Right.
Killer robots, etc. Not that killer robots are...
No, they're real.
When I see people shit on killer robots, right? Like, I mean, and I'm going to name drop now as somebody who I think is guilty of this. The kind of philosopher of technology, Luciano Floridi, who used to be at the Oxford Internet Institute. He was the director there. And now I think he's at Yale, possibly, right? And he just kind of like laughs on all this stuff about killer robots. And this is like, I think he calls it AI theism, right? A kind of like theological worldview. But if you take my more relational reading, well, we're already in the terrain of killer robots. I mean, what are drones, right?
Yeah,
sure.
And where are they being deployed? I mean, Ukraine on the one hand, but Palestine on the other, right? Horrendous technology. And you know, Anthony Lowenstein in his book, The Palestine Laboratory, right, just sees this as an open testing ground to, if you like, beta test these technologies before you're going to roll them out from the periphery back to the core, the boomerang effect. I mean, I say this because I think one of your guests in season one, he was talking about surveillance, and I'm not discounting surveillance, right?
Yeah, Chris Gilliard. Yeah.
But surveillance in a core setting is largely for what I would call biopolitical ends, right? It's about management of populations, you know, in terms of ensuring that the populations are thriving and in support of the state as enacting the biopolitical project, right? But that's for the core. When you get to the periphery, it's straight up necropolitics, right? These people are expendable, exterminable, just erase them, right? And that we've seen that in 2 years of an ostensible genocide. Whereas Dan talks about biopolitics and necropolitics in his book, Resisting AI, but I have a slightly different take to him on that because I think we need to tease them out in world systems terms, right? So for me, it's biopolitics for the core, necropolitics for the periphery. That doesn't mean that necropolitics might not be visited on the core and that biopolitics isn't also playing out in the periphery. I'm talking about what are the dominant orientations, if that makes sense. But let me kind of get back to the Butlerian jihad a little bit, if I may. So we have these three kind of positions, right? War against the machines, position one, augmentation via machines, some kind of cyborgism or transhumanism, position two, and third, domination by the machines. But it's really interesting, at least to me, to note that in his 1872 novel Erewhon, right, which is an anagram of nowhere, which contains within it something called the Book of the Machines. It's almost like some kind of secular scripture or something like that. You can think about it in those terms, right? A kind of an epic within an epic, if you want to think about Erewhon in those terms. In that book, he commits to the first of these positions. So in 1863, he starts writing these articles for the newspaper, a New Zealand newspaper, the first of which is Darwin Among the Machines. And, you know, it's against the machines, with the machines, and then dominated by the machines. But it's interesting in the 1872 novel that he returns to the first position, and that's the one he explores in the Book of the Machines. And I really, really recommend reading that. In fact, I want to reread it at some point, because when I was reading that in preparation for writing that paper, I was just like cutting out, I was taking screenshots with my phone or bits of the book, and then I was tweeting this. It's like, wow, this guy really was onto something. This is very prescient. And some scholars have argued that he is essentially the first serious scholar to mount a position, which I guess we would call the kind of like the Sarah Connor, John Connor position, right? It's a war against the Terminator, right? Because this technological assemblage is going to become autonomous, going to be out of control. We need to nip it in the bud. We need to fight against it, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, Yeah, in the essay, and kind of building upon different readings of Butler, and again, we're talking Samuel here, not Judith, by literary scholars and post-colonial theorists, I attempt to draw out the various class and racial dimensions at work in both the Book of the Machines, but also the wider context of the novel from a race-critical and decolonial perspective. And I also situate Butler's war against the machines against the backdrop of what might be referred to as the hauntological specter of Luddism, right? So we're all familiar with, there's a specter haunting Europe, the specter of communism, right? In the opening lines of the Communist Manifesto, right? But it was interesting some years back when I wrote this invited symposium, I think I called it Fugitive Decolonial Luddism, a Hauntology, right? And I came across this fascinating essay by two, I guess maybe Marxist, if not Marxist-leaning scholars, Kevin Robbins and Frank Webster, in one of their books. I can't remember the title of the book, maybe The Technocultural Imagination or something like that. But anyway, in I think the first chapter of that book, they specifically refer to the specter of Luddism. And I thought, yeah, let's run with that. That's a really interesting idea. I mean, the idea of hauntology, I mean, it goes back to the French philosopher, the founder of deconstruction, Jacques Derrida. And it's a portmanteau of haunting and ontology. So he brings these two together in the idea of hauntology. And what does he mean by that? Probably the best way to think about that is the presence of that which is absent. So if we think about Luddism, just think about it. I'm talking here about historical Luddism, so the movement in the north of England in the early decades of the 19th century surrounding the Industrial Revolution. It was put down very violently. You know, I mean, I listened to your podcast episode where you talk about how it's put down by various troops, right? I think it was the interview with Brian Merchant, right? His book, Blood and Machine.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think, you know, it's interesting to note that more troops were used to put down the Luddite uprisings, if not Luddite movement, than were in the fight against Napoleon.
I didn't know that, to be honest. I mean, you know, this is...
How many people are aware of this? So it was hangings, so executions, it was war, and there were also exiles, right? So you're just going to scatter, you know, scatter the ashes of this movement, right? But the movement has never died. It kind of lingers on as a kind of haunting every time a new technology that is potentially transformative. I'm not saying in a technologically determinist fashion, it's the driver, but it's entangled with various broader social, political, cultural, economic, ecological, and other transformations. Luddism resurfaces, whether that's as neo-Luddism in the 1990s, associated with the internet, etc. People like Kirkpatrick Sale in Rebels Against the Future, Chelis Dendinning, etc., etc. Right? There were various figures. But it's interesting it's resurfaced again. Some refer to it as neo-Luddism. I prefer to go back to Luddism, although I don't read it in the same way, maybe that Brian Merchant and other people do, which is, I would suggest, through a more kind of class-based economic lens, as being about the configuration of the social relations rather than the means of production itself, right? So the means of production might be fine. We just need to get the social relations, the relations of production right. And I'm suggesting, no, that's not the case, right? It might be that certain technologies should be abolished, full stop. They shouldn't be engaged with, right? And I don't think I'm doing Brian Merchant a disservice. I mean, I listened to a podcast this morning in preparation for this discussion, right? You know, I think I'm right in saying that he was essentially saying, you know, the technology in and of itself might be fine. It's just, unfortunately, the social configuration of it. That's what needs to be resisted. And I'm suggesting, no, certain technologies shouldn't exist. We should abolish them. We should effect rollback. So it's not just about jamming your foot in the door so that they don't get to be developed. I mean, maybe it's too late and the window's shut. Maybe we need to lob a Molotov cocktail through the window, break into the place, and then destroy the machine completely in true Luddite fashion. So maybe I have a slightly different reading.
I think his position might have evolved on that, to be honest. Okay. But, you know,
fair enough. I think that's fair enough. As I said, I don't want to do a disservice because, I mean, everyone's thinking hopefully changes and hopefully changes in the direction, right? So if I've kind of read him historically, well, just read it as historical, right? But just trying to differentiate my position somewhat, if that makes
Yeah.
I think he would agree with you, actually, that this technology shouldn't exist at all. We should just take the hammer to it or the Molotov cocktail, whatever it takes.
Right.
So.
Right. Or monkey wrench, right? Whatever works.
Whatever works.
Yeah, Captain Swing and what is it, General Ludd or King Ludd, right? Why not? So anyway, in that's one of the things I was kind of trying to explore towards the end of the essay was what I'm calling this ontological spectra of Luddism, which I think about as the persistent historical trace or the absent presence of an opposition to machinery harmful to the commonality, right? So often there's a tendency to think about the commonality in relation to, well, workers, right? Workers of the world unite against AI, LLMs, and the rest of it. And I'm suggesting this figure of the worker, now that's one possible reading, but I'm suggesting that it was much more diffuse and cultural and socially inflected than just reducing it down to labor relations, right? It's more than that. At least that's what I'm trying to argue here. People can disagree, obviously. So on this basis, and building on this earlier work that I referred to in a symposium, which took place, I think, back in 2018 or 2019, and I still haven't published this essay, so you'll just have to take my word for it that I did present it then. Yeah, I tried to make the case for what I've referred to elsewhere as a fugitive decolonial Luddism. So this is one that centers the historically marginalized and peripheralized, especially in the so-called global South, but that also draws upon the legacy of piracy, Luddism, because the Luddites were fugitives from the state, right? So piracy, Luddism, and maroon societies, the latter being forged by enslaved people of African descent escaping the plantations in the Americas. So this whole concept of fugitivity, I mean, I've yet to really flesh it out, you know, more deeply and engage more with the literature, because essentially I'm trying to write a book with that title, Fugitive Decolonial Luddism. I mean, this has only been in preparation for, what is it, 7 or 8 years? So I don't know what that says about me, but probably nothing good, but it is what it is, right? You just roll with it.
Good food comes slowly, you know?
Well, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much to read, right? I mean, when a tome like Blood in the Machine comes out and you think, oh my God, you've got to add that to the reading list as well, right? It just puts the project back X number of years. So I seem to be kind of like moving backwards in some sense, but okay.
I think your work is moving us forwards, though. I mean, I don't think you should underestimate that. I think your insights are incredible. So, you know, don't get too modest.
Well, it's not so much modesty. It's more likely my wife saying, well, everyone's publishing books. Where's yours, right?
Okay.
Right? Yeah, I mean,
your wife's onto something.
Well, I mean, Dan really put me in a tough spot, because when I met him, when his book had just come out, we sat down and had a chat, and he handed me a physical copy, and I'll just read you what he wrote. So this is in the inside cover. He just says, to Mustafa, my attempt to advance the cause of decolonial Luddism, over to you, exclamation mark. Right, so no pressure, right, guys? No pressure.
What a jerk.
No, but it's all good. It's all good. I mean, I really appreciate Dan's support and, you know, well, essentially bringing us together, right? So yes, I'm grateful to him for that and for many other things. But anyway, you know, having established this genealogical connection between Frank Herbert's Butlerian Jihad, Samuel Butler's views on autonomous technology, and a historically informed, yet maybe expanded reading of Luddism, I conclude my essay, that essay, by returning to the Butlerian Jihad, with a view to thinking about what this might mean in terms of motivating calls for a Butlerian jihad against AI and cognate technologies today. And as I said, part of this is prompted by the fact that there are already tech critics doing that, right? I mean, I don't know how serious they are about it, or whether they're just kind of comically riffing off science fiction as part of the socio-technical imaginary, or maybe doing some rhetorical work or something, but I'm actually quite serious about a Butlerian jihad. I hope that comes across in my writing, but, you know, that's obviously for the reader to determine. But, you know, maybe just to finish, later in the same year that essay was published, and that was last year, 2025, I had the opportunity to build on that essay in a panel discussion organized by Dan McQuillan, which formed part of a symposium on AI held at Goldsmiths University in East London. And in a paper entitled, and this is the title, De-Orientalizing the Butlerian Jihad, or Jihad, Full Stop, Now, full stop, which I hope to publish in the near future. But, you know, given my track record in relation to the book, I don't know if that's going to happen, right? Don't hold your breath, guys. Anyway, in that paper, I argued that, you know, contemporary calls for mounting a Butlerian jihad by tech critics, unfortunately, in my opinion, they betray a certain latent Orientalism, which surfaces if one shifts attention from the Butlerian to the jihad. So put simply, I'm suggesting that tech critics are much less likely to be comfortable with calls for mounting a jihad against AI, notwithstanding the fact that jihad essentially means struggle in the Arabic language and within the Islamicate tradition to which I belong. I mean, I'm not suggesting it only means that, right? Because different actors mobilize the term at different times. I mean, ISIS being the most nefarious and obscene forms of mobilization, right? But the concept itself, essentially, just linguistically at least, just means struggle, right? So the question is, how does that play out and how can that play out? Yeah, in the symposium piece, anyway, I point to the historical legacy of jihad in relation to anti-colonial struggles within the Islamicate world. So that would be the jihad mounted by Sheikh Abdul Qadir al-Jazairi in Algeria against the French. Sheikh Umar Mukhtar, also known as the Lion of the Desert. There's a movie about his life story, which I strongly recommend, with Anthony Quinn, who does a sterling job in the lead role, and mounting a jihad against the Italians under the fascist Mussolini. But also in the Caucasus, we have Sheikh Shamil or Imam Shamil, a Chechen, fighting against Russian incursions. And then in the African continent, we have Sheikh Uthman Danfouri mounting a jihad in that context. So, you know, jihad doesn't have to mean ISIS, guys, right? And don't get triggered, right? That's why I'm suggesting, because what is it that's triggering you? And I would suggest that there are these background currents as part of the imaginary, including Islamophobia, the war on terror, Orientalism, et cetera, et cetera. I should say that was one of the things I found really refreshing in the very first episode of your first season. You have maybe a Marxist, materialist, communist, or whatever orientation, but that you weren't averse to engaging with people who are maybe coming from a position informed by a religious tradition, a spiritual tradition, something additional to maybe the material, right? And that's where I situate myself anyway. Yeah, in that symposium piece, I pointed to the historical legacy of jihad in relation to these anti-colonial struggles, and also how jihad mobilizes both material and spiritual forces, right, to ground and orientate those engaged in acts of resistance. So this wasn't about some kind of spiritual, you know, and I would suggest, decadent and nihilistic withdrawal into the self, right? I mean, to hell with the external world. No. This was about we withdraw to spiritually charge, and then we burst out and we change the map of the world, or at least we try to in resistant anti-colonial struggle. And that's, so that's the kind of engagement with the jihad that informs my thinking. And anyway, I conclude that symposium paper by briefly thinking about what this might mean in terms of materially and spiritually opposing what I see as the ongoing rollout of AI as a colonizing socio-technical assemblage and infrastructure. And it's going to become critical infrastructure if we don't oppose it. That's my thinking on this. Because we've got dependencies in terms of education, in terms of law, healthcare, banking, on and on and on, right? I mean, even the existing infrastructure, such as the electrical grid, the water supply, transport networks, are themselves being subjected to some form of cybernetic control through these AI assemblages, right? I mean, it's just ironic. If you think about the infrastructure as a kind of stack, it's the top of the stack that's actually now kind of reflexively controlling everything further down the stack, right? And I'm not talking about the stack in the OSI setting exclusively. I'm talking about the infrastructural stack in terms of everything, right down to the telegraph, the railroads, everything.
Yeah, to support human life, basically. That's what the stack is meant to do.
Absolutely. The life world, right? It's colonizing the life world, and the more than the human life world as well, if they have their way. I mean, I've got this metaphor that I use in a different paper. I don't know which one it is or was, who knows? I mean, there's so many scribblings that I'm putting together, but I got this metaphor. I say that it used to be about boots on the ground, colonialism, right? Whether that's settler colonialism or non-settler variety colonialism. And I say we've shifted from boots on the ground to bits on the ground or bits on the ground colonialism by digital proxy. So this is why I always think about AI in relation to the internet, but also in relation to the Internet of Things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that more diffuse fabric, which, you know, supports, enables, powers this. And yeah, why is it being deployed? Well, in what I've referred to earlier as biopolitics and necropolitics, really.
Yeah. I think the other thing that's interesting about it, to your point about the stack, is that the weird thing about it, maybe is a better way of saying it, is that the stack is being not just managed by it, but consumed by it. So, for example, you know, electricity and water might end up being like, you might end up controlling the or optimizing the usage of that thing, whatever. But the main problem, the actual, that's a future imaginary which these people want to sort of like, oh, it's all about optimization, it's all about improvement, blah blah blah. No. What's really happening, the actual usage of electricity and water, is it's being diverted from humans, from the need to light up human cities and human houses and warm up human houses, to and water for human drinking or for agriculture to provide food for humans, to these data centers. You know, this is like they're taking critical resources away from the human race.
Yeah, but there's no need to worry, right? Because we're all going to upload into this material substrate other than our existing material substrate. And if there are resource concerns about how we power that, well, we're going to mine asteroids and we're going to harness the sun and we're going to colonize the universe anyway, right? And I think that's something that you explored in a previous podcast anyway. So,
yes, yes. It's a sardonic perspective. Yes,
yeah,
absolutely.
I mean, why limit your horizons, guys, if you're a colonialist? Put your foot on the accelerator.
Exactly. Exactly.
Go cosmological, right?
Yeah. Well, don't give these fuckers any ideas here. but so we've been talking for a while, and we really do appreciate your time and all of the thought that you've put into the responses to our questions. So, you know, I am with you in hoping that we see an actual Butlerian jihad. And, you know, I will happily lean into the kind of anti-colonial jihads of the past that we can celebrate. So I just wanted to give you the last words, Mustafa. Is there anything you would like to leave us with or our listeners with before we ride off into the night to smash the machines?
Right. Well, great use of your evening, guys. I don't know if your listeners are persuaded by the argument, but it's really just to make the case for reading these existential risk, existential threat, sci-fi, utopian / dystopian narratives presented by the tech bros and their fellow travelers, and also reading them oppositionally, but also thinking about constructive alternative imaginings, imaginaries. I mean, maybe just in closing, I mean, something that I haven't mentioned is, and this, you know, I think I mentioned earlier that in addition to kind of taking a race critical and decolonial position, increasingly I find myself engaging with what I call the three politicals, right? Political economy, political ecology, and political theology, right? Which I see as exploitation, extraction, and extermination. So it's from the three V's associated with big data, which was velocity, variability, and volume, to the three E's, right? Exploitation, extraction, and extermination, right? I mean, it's not a happy shift, but, you know, it's just a useful tripartite lens that I'm thinking about. So just in relation to that, I like to plug a 1930s book, because we talked about science fiction and we kind of fixated on the Duneverse, I guess. But I decided to read this text because I am sure that I had read somewhere on the internet or in my unfortunate encounter with transhumanist rhetoric and literature, that there was a text that often gets cited as the equivalent of secular, rationalist, humanist scripture by the transhumanists, extropians, singularitarians, and then some. And this is the book by Olaf Stapledon called Last and First Men.
Oh, right. Yeah.
I cannot recommend this book enough. I mean, I've only read it once, but, and I don't, when I read science fiction, I don't generally highlight the book, right? But there are plenty of orange highlights in my copy of that book because, I mean, if the Dune saga is epic, well, this is like hyper epic. It straddles not billions of years, but trillions of years. And this guy's writing in the 1930s, and he's writing it from this perspective of somebody in the remote future beaming a signal back and communicating a message about how evolved humanity is coming to an end. So it's, you know, in the same way that earlier you were talking about, I think it was Snow Crash and The Expanse and something else, I can't remember what it was, but in terms of, don't these tech bros see the, and hear and feel the social commentary embedded in these works? And I was suggesting they just bracket them out through an agnosticological or active ignoring perspective. I mean, these guys, you know, what is it when... what is it that's engaging them with Stapledon's vast historical narrative? And it could be that they read it as, we need to avoid this from happening. This is a possible future because it's being beamed back to us. It's an imaginary that has traveled back from the future into the present, even though it's written in the present by a then 1930s British philosopher and science fiction author. Olaf Stapledon. But yeah, maybe it's a kind of warning, right? That we don't want this to happen. We're very happy with the idea that the humanity is going to evolve, and actually we want it to evolve along our lines, which is along the lines of the, I mean, are you familiar with the acronyms GRIN and ENBIX? GRIN stands for Genetics, Robotics, IT, and Nanotechnology, right? And ENBIX is, I think, Nanotechnology, Biotechnology, Information Technology, Cognitive Science, and Synthetic Biology. Right? There's similar kind of terms. The crucial point is these guys see these as convergent technological phenomena. So it's not just about AI is the problem, right? So it's about computing, it's about LLMs, although it is about LLMs at the moment, but it's about this, the bleed over and the bleed through and the spillover into other domains. Right? What happens with when LLMs and the Human Genome Project and a eugenics project and a necropolitical project all start to converge? I mean they're already converging,
aren't they? Yeah, I was gonna say
we're already there, right? But at least maybe in closing thoughts, it's about to entertain this, to skill up and read up and think up and then act up on the basis of opposing this if it isn't something that chimes well with you. To take a line from a completely different genre, the superheroes, so the Dark Knight trilogy, there's a storm coming, Mr. Wayne, right? The storm is this clusterfuck that is all of these GRIN and ENBIX kind of developments. And I think we just need to prepare for the storm, weather the storm, and get ready for the battle. Whether it's already arrived or not, I think we need to kind of like get hip to it.
Yeah, I think that's fantastic. And, you know, the storm is coming also applies to Dune, you know, so we can tie a bow on that. But speaking of, you know, read up and get educated, I mean, your list of citations in your paper, I mean, I downloaded a bunch of PDFs and ordered like 5 different books that were still in copyright, just reading the citations. So I hope the show notes for this episode will have a similar effect on our listeners, because they're going to be heavy, let me tell you. Thank you so much again for giving us 2 hours of your Sunday afternoon or evening, as it is now. We look forward to reading more of your work, and thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for the invitation.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure. This is that bit at the end where we thank you for listening to this episode of Polytechs. First, we hope you enjoyed the show, and we really appreciate the time you have given to this subject. If you want to follow up with us, please send email to podcast@polytext.dev, because that's very direct and doesn't have any algorithms. If you prefer social media, we're at Polytex on Blue Sky and at Polytex at mastodon.social. We're not on Twitter for obvious reasons. To help the show reach a wider audience, please share it with your friends, family, and colleagues. There's nothing as good as a real human recommendation. You can find out more about the show on the website, which is polytext.dev. As you should expect, there are no cookies or tracking of any kind. All the show notes, transcripts, and contact details are over there. If you want to show a deeper level of commitment, there's also an option to donate. We're passionate about free and open access to the episodes, so there's no obligation and there are no benefits other than a warm feeling in your heart. Finally, we would really appreciate a 5-star review on your podcast platform. Reading positive reviews makes us feel good and can help others find the show and make them feel like it's worth their time. Okay, that's all the admin done, and we hope to see you next week. Bye!